This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Have you tried changing your health year on year, resolving that this year things are going to be different, but nothing seems to change? Oftentimes, when things are not changing, we're following many wellness myths and not looking at the full picture, including our nutrition, recovery, stress management, leaving out mind-body connection. I want to introduce you to Wellness Redefined, a new podcast from Rufilion Media that's here to dispel all your myths about wellness and fitness while sharing stories of how we've redefined what it means to be healthy. On each episode, we'll be talking to experts from all walks of life who will share their own unique wellness journey and offer their perspective. I am your host, Tamika Rochester, founder and CEO of Harlem Cycle, a premier wellness space in New York City with a focus on indoor cycling. I've been an advocate for wellness since as early as I can remember. So if this sounds like something that could help change your life, go ahead and pause the show you're listening to and subscribe to Wellness Redefined on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Inclusive Collective, where we bring you news and analysis of the latest in people and workplace culture. And we also share stories and learnings from inclusive people, organizations, and innovation. I am your co-host, Rob Hadley, a people and culture strategist specializing in diversity, equity, and inclusion, and people analytics. I'm here with my friend, Nadia Butt, workplace culture strategist and talent development consultant. Nadia, it is great to be back with you. How are you?
So good. Rob, it's been too long. Right? Did you miss
the world? The world feels that way. Everyone feels that way.
Yeah, the world went on fire while we were gone, by the way. I feel like it blew up. It
took like 1 week off, and right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now we're every other week.
Was it more on fire than it normally is? I don't necessarily feel like it.
Wasn't, but I feel like because we hadn't spoke in, you know, a few days that it probably felt like that.
It was like welling up inside of you.
Totally. I was like, I need to talk to Rob about this.
But you could still call me. It doesn't have to
be. I know. I guess I can.
The cameras don't have to be rolling.
That's true.
For us to chat.
That is very true. I want to say Eid Mubarak to the people out there. Eid will be tomorrow. So I just wanted to send my, you know, celebrations to those folks that are observing and celebrating, and to employers, give the day off to your employees. Be nice.
maybe. Cool. Awesome. Well, what else is going on? What do we got today?
So this week on Inclusive Collective, we're so fortunate. We're going to be talking to Lena Maria Kenyon, the co-founder at Neur Group. We're also going to be talking about the closing of Congress's DE&I offices, the census changes, and we're going to close out by raving about the women's NCAA. I'm sure you're excited about that.
I am.
Ranting about SHRM.
the not a person named SHRM. Yes,
not a person named SHRM. SHRM, the organization. Society
awesome.
Of Human Resource Management.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's get started here.
Let's do it.
And I've lost track of how the show is supposed to go. So let me go ahead and get started. All right. So this week, Donna, you mentioned the Congress, like the big one there in Washington, D.C., District of Columbia. Yeah. They disbanded the House Office of Diversity and Inclusion. So this is something that people don't necessarily think about a lot in terms of, you know, congressional staffers and what that looks like. These are the people that do all of the work in our legislative branch, right? So again, remember when Mitch McConnell was freezing up and not doing anything and people were really worried about that? But I wasn't really worried about that because I know that these people don't do a lot, right? The real people that do all the work on Capitol Hill are the legislative staff. So I don't really necessarily think it's bad if our senators are inoperable. But the people that do everything are highly unrepresentative of the rest of us. Well, I guess not. They're pretty representative of me. But congressional staff of color are about 18%. That's up from 14% in 2018. And that was one of the reasons that the office was established. This comes a month or a little over a month after the White House director of DEI left but was not replaced. Nadia, all these symbols of things going in a different direction. What are your thoughts on
that? I mean, are we surprised? Like, you know, I at this point, I will be honest. Like, I truly don't have much to say. Only, like, I just continue to shake my head. Like, I read this article, and then also last week, University of Texas Austin also shut down their DEI offices. So the end of the semester will be the last day for many of the staffers in DEI. So, you know, the key here is, like, the work has to continue. I don't care. Don't call it DEI, but the work has to continue. You have to continue to make efforts to ensure that your staff reflects the country and reflects your community. So, because then you understand where the problems are. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, it's dumb. It's, like, all dumb.
Well, I mean, so I don't know. Have you ever worked in a congressional office? Or I know you have a political family. You ever, folks ever worked in
I've never in worked in a congressional
on
office.
On legislation or, right? I mean, these are the folks that do all the work. Like those staffs in D.C., they do everything, right? And so, like, they could literally slip things into bills and the rest of us could live with it for the rest of our life.
Right.
You know, unbeknownst to our senators, right? So these are some of the most important
super influential
in creating legislation, super influential, right? They're literally the people that are sitting right next to your senators and having conversations and telling them what direction that should go, how they should vote on bills, right? So, you know, so it appears often, and you and I share this agreement, that our government's not necessarily responsive to the will of the people. And this is another example of why, right? And so it's just going to continue to get less responsive, I think, certainly for people that are underrepresented in the government. So I don't know. I'm a little bit bummed out. And I think the symbolism also is important. I think that Republicans certainly see this as a win. And it's just remarkable how swiftly the pendulum has swung. And I guess somewhat surprised that I don't think that Democrats could do anything about this, right? So the Republicans offered this bill and they're not going to shut down, funding the government for this one particular office.
Sure.
But it is like, but it just shows you that this was something that probably, a couple of years ago would be unfathomable as a bargaining chip. It's probably like how many people on it can't cost any money. And this is something that is specifically targeted by Republicans to take out and then very little pushback from Democrats.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's all true. When I think of, like, what could we do or what can be done, I just think of, like, grassroots efforts of folks running for offices, like, whether it's at the local level, then eventually, getting to your state level and then the federal level. And the key is like, at the end of the day, representation matters. And so I do think that even if you are a Congress rep, and you want to work, you want to employ people who are representative of your communities, then you will take it upon yourself to make sure that those folks are hired into those positions, or at least have influence into some of that decision making.
Yeah.
And so that means to me that we got to have more people running for office that are from marginalized communities. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking about running for your local or for your state or for your federal seat, then do it. Like, let's get some funding.
And I mean,
this is not going to become a political podcast, but I think there's an opportunity there for grassroots efforts.
And I think and I 100% agree with you. I think that, but it also shows that at the federal level, an office like this has a really important function because you could organize as much as you want here in Utah, you're not going to win. Okay, like you could be inspired. You could say, I'm gonna try to have some impact at the state level. It's the deck is completely stacked against you. It's certainly obviously in a place like Massachusetts, like by all means, and people have organized and done a great job.
Yeah.
So that's why an office like that is very important. And I am a little bit sad that that folks won't have that support there.
Yeah. Keep an eye on it. We will keep an eye on that.
2 weeks from now, we'll see what it looks like.
We'll see. Yeah, 2 weeks from now, we'll return to it. Okay, so let's move on here. At the end of March, Rob, the Office of Management and Budget, so it's the OMB, announced changes to how the federal government asks about people's race and ethnicity, including in the U.S. Census. So the government will now collect, well, has been collecting race and ethnicity or as much information as possible. They were using originally a single question and will include a new Middle Eastern and North African category as a choice. The question measuring a respondent's race or ethnicity will now include 7 broad categories. So now there's white, Hispanic or Latino, Black or African American, Asian, American Indian or Alaska Native, Middle Eastern or North African, and Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander. Under the previous standards, Hispanic or Latina ethnicity was measured in a question separate from one on racial identity. This is the first time in nearly 3 decades that the existing standards have been changed. Any thoughts or reactions?
I think they rationalized it based on what we now know. I think that race is really important to capture and disaggregate. And I think there's a lot of efforts to make sure that we don't capture and disaggregate race data, right? So if we really want to truly understand historical inequities in the way that we can then go and take action to rectify some of those historical inequities, then we need to understand race at a level, probably even another level lower than what we're talking about here, but this is a nice start, right? So for example, the Middle Eastern North Africa piece is just a really big miss for a long time, and certainly something that you're excited to have that data and understanding of that particular population, and then just the broader disaggregation of Asia, of Asians, which were lumped together as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You know, overall, like more people will be seen, more people will feel included and heard. I think a little bit more, maybe a little bit more accurate data. But I will just also share, I read an article in The Hill last week that commented on the new standards, creating a whole new form of exclusion when it comes to Afro-Latinos. And this exclusion endangers the full enforcement of civil rights. So according to the article, quote, the new OMB standard now combines both inquiries into a single question of what is your race and or ethnicity, and collapses Latino / Hispanic ethnic identity into the list of ethno-racial categories with Black, White, Asian, American Indian, Middle Eastern, and Native Hawaiian. While the OMB proposal is not technically naming Latino as a race, by inserting Hispanic Latino as a category commensurate with Black, this article says it not only situates Blackness as foreign to Latino identity, it also encourages a view of the Black category is only pertaining to non-Latinos in ways that erase the very existence of Afro-Latinos and discourages multiple box checking. So I bring this up because, again, like overall, like I had said, more people are being seen. You also, you know, mentioned like more people will be seen, more people will be heard, a little bit more authentic data. But still, we continue to kind of put people in boxes, which I think is quite often the case when we are trying to gather data that is, you know, somewhat representative and hopefully unidentifiable, depending on, you know, kind of how you're collecting data and who you're collecting data on. But it just continues to me, it continues to showcase that race is a construct. It's a social construct. And we just want to put people in boxes so that we can capture identities and experiences.
Yeah, it's all a great point. It is tough. I mean, I think, but I do support, I think that you're seeing these efforts, right, and certainly here in Utah. I know that, you know, we've talked about Utah. We're going to talk about Utah again a little bit later.
Yeah, but are we?
I'm always excited to talk about Utah. But there's efforts to stop collecting this data, right, and around race. And so the argument is that socioeconomic data is more important. Right. So, I mean, that's it. And the argument is that we don't see race. Race is not necessarily important in 2024. And so, I really find that troubling because if we stop collecting race data, you know, we don't always have the right socioeconomic data. Right. And so the biggest predictor of your socioeconomic experience in this country is your race, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's
sure.
So like we need to use all these things together.
Of course.
And that race component is such a big part of it. And you're, and I totally agree that like it's like almost like any data collection. It's arbitrary. We're talking about a social construct, right? And we are trying to put people in boxes.
Yeah.
We just try to put people in boxes for everything.
Sure.
And so you know, if you're doing it correctly, you're doing it so that you can solve problems, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah. So that's where I'm a big advocate of continuing to make sure that we do a good job of collecting race data.
Agree. And I do hope that it doesn't take another 30 years for them to come back to understand, are we actually collecting the right data? Like, I think there needs to, right? This is like what we kind of teach our clients is you have to continuously be monitoring and adjusting whatever kind of solution you're implementing. So I would encourage folks at this OMB organization to consider how will you continue to measure and track, you know, and understand if the data you're collecting is accurate and enough or if it's sufficient, right? So like put in a year to like readjust if needed, or maybe not a year, maybe it's 3 to 5. I don't know.
Yeah.
But don't wait 30 years.
But it's a great point because these offices are run by political appointees. Ooh. And so it becomes
Let's circle
something...
back to the very first, we're closing the loop here.
We're going, it's 2024. Yeah. But the political appointee can say, we're going to change this tomorrow, right? We're not going to collect race data. We're not going to think about race data. We're either going to do a bad job or no job at all. And so those are little things that are very important.
Yeah, you're right.
All right. Thanks, Nadia. That is it for the deets. This week, we had a lot to say there. We'll be right back with our guest, Lena Canyon. Stay with us on Inclusive Collective.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As we migrated more of our business to the cloud, we were seeing expenses go up, but we couldn't pinpoint the cause. It seemed less of a cloud, more of a fog. That's why we brought on Cloud Optimizer, and they saved the day.
Are you seeing your cloud hosting bills go up and you're not sure why? It's time to put Cloud Optimizer to work for you. Cloud Optimizer analyzes usage patterns, right-sizes resources, leverages discounts you may not be aware of, implements automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service.
With Cloud Optimizer, we have our spend under control. Our company is more agile, profitable, and we're getting peak performance from our cloud.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
Welcome back, folks. Really excited. This week we welcome Lena Maria Canyon, the co-founder at Noor Group, a collective of first-generation women of color. Born in Colombia, being the first in her family to attend college, Lena is a graduate of Suffolk University and earned an MBA from Boston University's Questrom School of Management. She is a recent graduate of Mendoza Ventures Fellowship and sits on Union Capital Boston's advisory board. She serves on Bikes Not Bombs Board of Directors and is a lead volunteer at the Dorchester Bike Kitchen. She is part of the Consultative Council of Nonprofit Leaders and is a steering committee member of Dorchester Art Project. Lena's passion for social change efforts brought her to create programs focused on topics such as homelessness, civic engagement, education, and youth advocacy. She's been in leadership roles at Chica Project, previously served in the AmeriCorps, was peer advisor for the Obama Foundation, enhanced the volunteer and internship program at the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate, and paired college interns with Boston nonprofits while at the College for Social Innovation. In 2019, Lena was recognized as one of Boston's 30 Under 30 Most Influential Latino Leaders by El Mundo Boston. Rob, this intro doesn't even do it justice. There's so much more that she has done. It's really, really quite remarkable. Welcome, Lena. Thank you for joining us on Inclusive Collective this week.
Thank y'all so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Lena, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for joining us today. So there's a lot there. We're going to try to hit all of it in the short amount of time we had. But so let's start with Neuro Group, right? So the group that you founded. And so the purpose there, and it's a big purpose, right? So to redefine what it means to be a first-generation woman of color. And then you focus on bringing light to a collective of first-generation leaders that embody cultural, spiritual, migrant, and social diversity through various services that you do. So that's a big, big mission, right? So talk about it. Tell us about that mission, why now, and how it's going.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with saying what Nur means. So Nur means light in Arabic, and folks often are like, what is this? But it's essentially the Light Collective, and that's what we launched. That's 2020, and we are now Nur Group, as we've shifted away from the collective piece and more to the business aspect of it. And it came out of my first year at my MBA program meeting my co-founder and business partner, Sajda Ali, who had this amazing personality, and we kind of just linked because we were both experiencing the same things in this MBA program of being the first, of being women of color, of seeing that things were not tailored, were not inclusive, were not really specifying diversity, and wanting that collective piece. So how do we bring other women along? Sajda's background is she's a first-gen American from an Indian family. And she's also Muslim. So again, all of our intersections. And I'm a first-gen Colombian immigrant. I came here when I was 10, that grew up in low income, and all of the isms, you know, that we experienced just by being part of the first-gen immigrant wave. And so being an MBA in an MBA program in Questrom is really what brought us together and launched the collective, which was essentially like a membership platform. This is literally 2019, so right before 2020 and right before DEI became a marker word. And everywhere that we went and we sold like our story of like, we just need spaces to come with each other and say, hey, this is only showing up in my class or in my work or in my family. Like, how do we talk about this? Folks were like, oh, that sounds like a nonprofit. Go launch a nonprofit. And as somebody who has been a nonprofit for like over a decade now, I was like, no, it is not a nonprofit. I'm telling you, this is a business idea. Mm-hmm. And so long story short, 2020 happened and we had a lot of buy-in. We had at our company launch, we really saw the beautiful intersection that Nur was providing to folks because we had folks who were the first to come out in their family, mm-hmm. the first to leave their Mormon family, the first to immigrate to the U.S. And these are drastically different identities or pieces of their identity. But they were being brought together because being the first in that had the same type of challenges, sure. same type of narrative, encountering same type of atmosphere. And so we did, 2020 happened, the DEI wave came our way. And then folks were like, remember that idea you had? Like, can we run that back? And then one thing that we saw is a lot of collectives were already building. So we said, how can we formalize this in a space that can also move social capital, but really center in a cross-sector lens? Because we need collective solutions and intersecting cross-sector solutions to respond to these issues. Mm-hmm. And so we pivoted to Nur Group about a year and 4 months ago, and we're out here strong with a branch that does a lot of consulting for leaders, nonprofits, social impact communities. And then the other branches that we have is a venture capital model of investment mm-hmm. for social impact leaders. So in short, that is what we do. And what we are trying to do is bring folks together to unlearn, relearn, and create new things.
That is fantastic, Lena. And I love when you said Nur and what the meaning was. I appreciate that. Just being someone who, you know, has an understanding, a little bit of an understanding around the Arabic word. So you were part of the leadership at Chica Project, a Boston nonprofit working to close the opportunity divide for young Latinas and women of color. You also, like I had said in your bio, you were previously working with as a peer advisor for the Obama Foundation. You know, worked in internship programs at the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate. Like, you've done all of these, like, even diverse kind of roles and work really, you know, around topics like you mentioned, like civic engagement, homelessness, education. I'm curious, I'd love to learn a little bit more about parts of your own identity and what has shown up as an immigrant at a young age for you that really kind of made you pivot into all of these different areas of work and industries, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll name a couple of things. And I think the first one is my life is such a first gen representation, and not just in the terms of like having to be the first that does many things, but also the not knowing what I don't know. Mm. And so a lot of these places where I landed are the expertise that now makes me this like really multi-layered and multi-experienced individual comes from just not knowing and doing what somebody suggested and trying it out. And so even the first one, I've been working since I was 13 years old, y'all. Uh-huh. Like when I do this math and I'm now, this is my Jesus year, I'm 33 this year. So I'm like, wow, I look back and I'm like, for 20 decades, I've been in different industries. And I started in the hospitality industry as a housekeeper, as a waitress in a nursing home. So I knew like, and again, you don't really think about this when you're a youth and you're like just 13 serving tables in a nursing home. But right now I look back and I'm like, wow, that really gave me the lens to see how we treat the elderly, what services they're needing, what technology gaps exist, right? Mm-hmm. So now my social issues lens is reapplied. But back then, you don't know that. So I went from being a housekeeper to a gate to working in the kitchen, then to working at the front desk, and was going to graduate from high school and be like a supervisor. And I was, my whole first gen family was like, Lena's going to get a salary job. It's the main thing. And then my high school was like, absolutely not. You're going to college. And I'm like, what? Why would I pay for school? Like, I came here to go to school for free. And I got a full ride at Suffolk. And I would say that that's really where this happened, where Suffolk gave me the opportunity to enter a space that I would have never entered, and do it in a way that I really took advantage of everything. So going into Suffolk, I picked my major, and I am so, and it's funny and also like a true reflection of not knowing what you don't know. I picked a criminal justice major when I entered Suffolk because I watched Law and Order SVU, and I was like, I'm going to be a detective in an elite squad in the special victims unit. And then I get in there and I'm like, oh, this is what that job looks like. No. Let me pivot. And so I added a second major, which was my government international relations degree, right? Mm-hmm. So again, a lot of these things just come from not knowing and trying them out. Sure. And while at Suffolk, I tried everything. I tried dance team. I started a bike club. I was in SGA. I was in the Hispanic Association. I was a scholar. I started traveling and seeing Habitat for Humanity and nonprofit. And I'm like, wait, nonprofit is a sector? Like people get paid to like do good.
Not a lot.
And not, and even that, you know, Rob, what you're alluding to, like not a lot. I didn't know that. I was like, wait, I can work and do good. And then you have your family back home saying, you're supposed to be a lawyer or a doctor and build houses for all of us back home. What are you doing? Because I entered that AmeriCorps year where I was getting paid nothing. And then the government shutdown happened. And it was like, well, what's Lena going to do? I will say these experiences are what have made me this multi-layered. The first employment that I got out of that recession was being a case manager for individuals who had experienced homelessness, had some sort of documented mental or physical disability, and were part of this program. And, you know, you're fresh out of college. I'm like, I'm going to save the world. I'm going to do good. And then you're getting, you know, hit left and right with, oh, there's systemic issues in our education. Oh, there's a huge substance abuse problem that is literally an intersection of government policy, support, healthcare, and you start seeing the vastness of the issues that are in front of you and really thinking about what is it am I proficient and how do I make impact? And so that's really where I rerouted, went into nonprofit. And at every nonprofit, I was finding the same issues. Nobody at the leadership board or funding level looked like the people from the communities that they were serving. So to your question, Nadia, of like, how does my, you know, identity tie into this, is I was always advocating for my lived experience and the people around me saying, hey, you know, you're making a decision about this client who used to have bed bugs. Have you ever had bed bugs? You know, you're making this decision about this client who needs a ride to the SNAP office or the social care. Have you ever been on Social Security? And that experience and lived experience gap is huge because you don't put that on the resume, right? You don't put, I've experienced these things and it gives me that ability. So that's how I've ended up in all of these places. And I think that landing at Nude, that's why, Rob, that lengthy, you know, mission that you read is important to us, because that post 2020 in the U.S. has a lot of work. We talk a lot about diversity when it comes to race and when it comes to gender, and rightfully so, because race and gender issues are big ones in the U.S. And we often overlook the different other intersections that are needing that as well, which is the social, the immigrant, the spiritual. Like, what does it mean, especially in the U.S. when I do love this country and I look at it and I'm like, I would have never met so many amazing, truly diverse people had I not come to this country. And what does that look like for us moving forward? So that's kind of how I ended up where I'm at and focus on so many areas and really experiencing and being able to advocate for a lot of the issues and causes that I do.
Yeah, I really like that, you touched on the gap between, you know, in the nonprofit industry, right, between the cultural, spiritual, the migrant and social diversity and the lack of representation within leadership in those organizations of some of those factors. So let's shift gears a little bit into something that's where there's a huge gap in terms of representation, and that would be in venture capital, right? And so you spent a little time with our friends at Mendoza Ventures. I don't know if you know, we had Senefer on the podcast. Oh, I think she was one of our first season guests. Yeah. You know, love Senefer and what she has done there. And so, you know, tell us about that experience. And then, you know, one of the things that she talked about and was very passionate about was like the only way to change things is to write a check, right? Is like to have the influence from an investment capital perspective. That is the biggest lever that you can pull in order to change direction, both within business and in society more broadly. And so just talk about some of the things that you learned there and then how that impacted you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for this question. Oh, because I think, again, those aha moments that until you're there, you're not able to be like, oh, this is how this happens. I had the amazing, when I speak about my work in nonprofit, I've worked both in direct service, but I've also worked in philanthropy. And that was a huge eye opener for me of seeing how folks made decisions around what they wanted to fund, how they funded it, how long they funded it. And a huge also almost like trauma-inducing moment to be in spaces where the only people that look like me are the folks who are cleaning the office of the meetings where you're at, right? And so Mendoza Ventures was a somewhat similar experience because when you look at VC, you see, and I'm sure if Senefer was here, she threw numbers at y'all, like how many women are there?
Yeah.
How many people of color are in venture capital? It's very little and it's the same in philanthropy. And I think my experience there allowed me to see two things. One is that there's no real difference between nonprofit and for-profit in this country other than what we are expecting in return, right? So when you're a philanthropic investor or when you're a donor or a funder, you are getting the return of feeling good, that like social capital that you get to say like, look who I supported, the generosity piece, right? And when you're a venture capital investor, you're getting a return on investment. Whether we like it or not, we live in a capitalist society. Capitalism is the economy of the U.S., whether we subscribe to it or not. But that is how this world works and this country in particular works. And so needing that valuation of return, it's important for any type of investment that you do. So that was my biggest learning that came out of there. My second biggest learning that came out of there is that it's not it. It's not the answer to all of it, right? It's a center for saying writing a check. Absolutely. In a capitalist society, moving money is power and how we make decisions. And Nude, for example, didn't want to go the traditional venture capital route. And then when we tried to pitch our idea of Nude as a venture capital firm, folks would often come back and be like, well, what sector are you focusing on? Are you doing tech? Are you doing? And we were like, no, we're just doing what now folks are calling social impact, right?
Yep.
But every time we tried to do a monetary valuation of the services that nonprofits or social leaders provide, folks were like, I don't see the return. And so for the DEI lens that we now wear, the return is the shared responsibility that we all have to sustain our world and the people in it. And that is a very radical thing to say to venture capitalists who, or investors who are like, I'm just trying to see how much dividends I'm going to get at
the
end
of the
year.
Return? Right.
So those are my biggest learnings. And it was an amazing experience. But I left there feeling like, we can create something new.
Yeah.
So we don't have to use the systems that are created like philanthropy or venture capital. We can surely create something new that hits on abiding by the current financial system that we're in, but being truly innovative and innovative in building solutions that are cross-sector. And that takes a lot of unlearning and relearning. And that's kind of like the machine arm of Node, is that social piece that we're trying to have folks really jump into the bandwagon of.
I love it. Lena, you're like a disruptor. You make just prior experiences and even current, like you're making so much change and just have this, outlook on the world and your community for really good. And I'm just wondering, like, when are you going to run for office?
That is so funny. That was been the plan. Before Julia Mejia got elected, I remember I jumped into, like, when she was running, I too was thinking about running. I did the courses. I went through Campaign Lab. I had folks who were ready to go. Yeah. And you also have to determine, like, where the space that you can create the most impact is and the things that you have to give up by being an elected leader. Because, hey, if anybody wants to appoint me, I'm right here.
I'm right here.
The election piece and the impact that it would have on myself as somebody who experiences burnout and has a very vulnerable immigrant family and background, I decided that it wasn't worth it for myself and my mental health. And those are decisions that elected officials have to make. And
Absolutely.
I mean, you see Michelle Wu constantly, the polarization of the politics in this country are not something that I wanted to put myself in. Yeah. However, that without the partisanship piece, if there's anybody out there who's looking for an appointed position and would like to consider your girl, let me tell y'all, I would be in there. I would be in there. And that's why I went to school for that and can advocate for my community in various ways.
I love that. The only
reason is not something I'd do.
The only reason I ask is my sister's an elected official and she has said that, like, I think for women, they have to be asked at least on average, like 7 or 8 times before they actually decide to run for office. So
absolutely.
I don't know how many other people have asked, but consider me the next person. Add that to the list.
I just had many crews. So I also teach at Suffolk on the side. And just like my side hustle as a professor, I had many crews in my class recently, a representative of Massachusetts, that said, I ran because people asked me to. Mm-hmm. And that resonates because the reason why people should run is because they get asked to. Mm-hmm. And they have to discern for themselves, am I willing to do this? Right? Because there's a lot you give up as you take on that responsibility.
Absolutely.
And I'm also 33, y'all. So don't count me out.
Right. You get a long way to go.
That is right.
You need a few specks of gray in your hair to truly effectively run for office.
Yeah.
A couple specks of gray.
Yeah.
You're not there yet.
Yeah.
And so I think Michelle Wu actually listens to this podcast. So, you can expect that appointment anytime. Yeah. Just sit back. This has been a lot of fun. And I want to start to wrap up, but just, do you have any resources that you're passionate about now that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
Absolutely. So I was thinking about this of like, who can I put in? Who can I plug? And there is just so much, especially in Boston right now. But the one thing that I wanted to pull back in thinking about, where is it that I get my information about being innovative or being truly radical? And it's not forgetting to be on the ground with people. Mm-hmm. And I think Dorchester, our project where I currently sit as a steering committee member, we are experiencing an age of being a lot of a technological simulation, but also resource fatigue. Like, we're just getting resources left and right. And we're forgetting Gen Zs, y'all too, because I teach Gen Zs and I see this.
Yeah.
We're forgetting that the best resources and the best ways to actually build collective missions and collective work is to be on the ground with folks. Mm-hmm. So my resource would be, I often go to Cocoa Leaf in Dorchester, our homestead. Those are my cafes where I sit at and engage with intergenerational folks that come in.
Nice.
Asking your neighbor, talk to your neighbors, talk to the people in your community. Dorchester Art Project right now is trying to really highlight the experience of artists in Boston. So talk to the artists, be curious. And that is my biggest resource, the people on the ground, the youth that are in Boston, in the nonprofit and social impact business leaders that are in our communities that are providing me the innovation and the resources that I need to move forward. So find your closest cafe, talk to your neighbor, talk to your peers, and get out your house and off your phone, y'all. Off of social media for 2.5 years now, and it has been the best decision that I made in my life.
Rob probably highly recommends that. Yeah, Rob's a big believer of that too. So it's
Highly recommend. Yeah,
that's great. Well, thank you. Super powerful. Love this conversation. We hope you join us back in the future. But Lena Kenyon, thank you so much for joining us on Inclusive Collective this week.
Thank y'all so much. I'm grateful to be here. Adios.
Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back for our con reflections and raves and rants.
Welcome back to Inclusive Collective. We just finished chatting with our guest, Lena Kenyon of Nur Group. Nadia, What a fun person to hang out with for a few minutes.
Like, so fun. She's done so many different, like, cool things.
Oh, I know. And what'd she say? She told us her age, right?
So Yeah, she told us her age.
I feel
she's done so much more. I know. Like, she's done so much in, like, such a shorter amount of time. And I'm like, ooh, I got to do some self-reflecting.
Maybe I shouldn't go snowboarding this afternoon.
Yeah. No, I mean, I got to say, I first of all, I appreciate all the work that she's done. She's very community driven and really appreciated her recommendation at the end of the conversation, right? Around really spending time like on the ground with people to really understand like what people might be, you know, working towards or struggling with or have challenges with. And I think that's actually speaks to like such an innovative mindset.
Right.
Because when you kind of learn what folks are struggling with, then you start to think of ideas to improve a process or an experience, you know?
Yeah. I appreciate it as well, because I was thinking about how the fact that I work from home for several years and I can barely get out the door. Like every week I'm like, I'm going to work out. I'm going to go out. And and then you're like, well, it would take me like 35 minutes to get, you know, to go someplace.
To get there and get back. I know.
And
you make up so many excuses.
You can't innovate. It's harder to innovate without seeing what's out there, right? Like without being outside and in the community. So I think that that's a really cool, especially in the role and the type of impact that she wants to have. She has to be out and discussing these things with other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can just sit in my office and that has literally no
impact. Talk to me all week.
I get a window into the world talking to Nadia every day. All right, so you ready for a little rant and raven?
Little rant and raven. It looks like you are going first with the rant. What do you got this week?
I'm going to go first. It might be a long one. I don't know. Let me see. So I was very disappointed by SHRM and its leader, Johnny Taylor Jr. this past week. As you know, as I mentioned earlier, I live in Utah and I attended a wonderful event about culture building presented by Bamboo HR. So great job by those folks. This was last week. And then headlining that event was our governor here and then Johnny Taylor Jr. And so I was really disappointed that Mr. Taylor not only appeared with our governor, who, as you know, when we alluded to earlier, has signed legislation outlawing DEI in K-12 and universities, one of the strictest bans of this type in the country. And first of all, I totally understand a leader of a national organization having to appear on stage with political figures, right? Even if you don't agree with them, you're there. You represent a national organization. But Mr. Taylor Jr. went much further, even suggesting that our governor be elected president.
So
I don't know if Mr. Taylor, who speaks eloquently and passionately about DEI for SHRM, on behalf of SHRM, and SHRM actually has lobbied against some of these DEI bans, I don't know if they knew our governor's position and that they will limit opportunities for people in Utah from underrepresented and marginalized and minoritized backgrounds in both education and then obviously in their employment situations going forward. I didn't know if they understood the full effect of the laws that he signed. And maybe he was just collecting a speaker's fee, right, for himself or the organization. But it was just very disappointing and off-brand. So I think that they should take stock of who they are appearing with and think about how they're representing that brand.
Yeah. Super disappointing to hear that. Yeah, that's disappointing. Well, thanks for that rant.
Yeah.
Good rant. So I'm going to rave today, Rob, and I want to try to do it in under a minute because I really want this to be a clip. So,
okay.
Rob, it was March Madness, and as you know, you'd love for this podcast to be a sports broadcasting one, but it's not. So I'm not going to announce the winners of such madness, but I did want to highlight a few things from the games of basketball. So apparently, per ESPN, 16.1 million people were tuning into the NCAA women's tournament, being the most watched college basketball ever on ESPN platforms, We had ballers like Iowa's Caitlin Clark, the most prolific scorer in NCAA history, and LSU's Angel Reese, the NCAA's record holder for double-doubles. And I wanted to also highlight that although these folks were not the first, there was NC State's Jenna Asa and UC Irvine's Diaba Jonte, who, and I apologize if I mispronounced those names, who were bringing representation and inspiration to the world, being Muslims by wearing hijabs while playing basketball. And with record viewership and attendance, I think this was just really great for our visibility all around, right? I'm here for it. Fun fact, the first to wear hijab was Bilqis Abdul-Qadir about 10 years ago, and she was very instrumental in getting the International Basketball Federation to overturn its own ban on headgear in 2017.
Wow.
Kind of cool, right?
Very amazing. Very amazing.
What did I miss about NCAA? Anything?
anything
did you
about
watch
the games?
Did you watch
I
the
watched,
games?
You know what I did? I actually did. I wasn't watching them from start to finish, but I definitely was like tuning in because family was watching it.
Yeah.
And really fun. Like really. I love basketball. Like I know you don't believe that, but I used to play and I was in tune, not necessarily with NCAA, but definitely NBA and now WNBA. And yeah, just like the NCAA, I feel like there's just a little bit more passion, maybe. They're college students that really are like, you know, like honing in on their skills and really fun to watch.
Yeah, it's really cool because the men's game, which has changed a lot based on the fact that the best players leave after a single year. And so within the women's side, you actually get to know these players over the course of their career. They stick around. They can actually make more money if you're a star like Caitlin Clark in college than they can in the WNBA, which is a commentary for another time, which that's unfortunate in a lot of different ways.
Like,
but you really become attached to them, and it has that feel which the men's game used to have of everyone's really excited about, and everyone kind of just picks a team, even if their college isn't in it. But if your college is in it, then you're just that much more passionate.
So excited. Yeah.
Super fun. And I'm all in. And, you know, I think it's a very exciting time for women's college basketball.
Love it. All right, folks. Well, that's it for Inclusive Collective. Just a reminder that if you're looking for DE&I and workplace culture, strategy consulting, problem solving, or training, you can reach out to me at Nadia@nazconsultants.com or Rob@ticanoconsulting.com. Inclusive Collective is a production of Refilia Media and edited by Ari Mathay. We would love to hear from you folks, so please send us your feedback at inclusivecollective@refilia.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn so you can subscribe to our IC newsletter. If you like what you heard, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast and rate us, give us 5 stars, wherever you get your podcasts today. Thanks again to our guest, Lena Kenyon. We will be back in 2 weeks, folks. We look forward to seeing you then. Be well.
Thanks, Nadia.
Bye.